All right, so now let's pick up in verse 8 with these so-called minor judges. Some people think that these are just stuck in here in order to bring the total number of judges up to 12, but actually there's a lot going on here in the details. Remember the key issue that we have seen since Gideon. Okay, the key issue is Israel seizing glory ahead of time instead of waiting to receive glory. That's been a temptation for man, even going back to the Garden of Eden with the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. That was the glory tree. That was the tree of kingly rule and dominion. And instead of waiting for God to give them access to that tree when the time was right, they seized that kingly glory ahead of time. Of course, in my sermon series on 1 Samuel, we've seen that, where Israel seizes the glory that comes with monarchy ahead of time instead of waiting for God to give it. God was going to give it. We know that because laws for kingship had already been given through Moses. So God was going to give them a monarchy, a dynasty, all of that glory was going to be theirs. But they had to wait for God to give it to them. But we already see with Gideon how they're starting to jump the gun. And so with Gideon, remember, they came and said, "Will you be a king and you can reign over us and your sons can reign over us?" And at first Gideon says, "No, you have the Lord your God as your king," which was the right answer. But then not long after that, Gideon begins to take on some of the trappings of you could say, worldly kingship. He becomes a king like the nations, like a pagan king. And he multiplies wives, so he has 70 sons. And one of those sons turns out to be named Abimelech, which, you know, Abimelech, that means my father is king. And we saw what a disaster that was. So he had these dynastic aspirations. We saw the same kind of thing with Jephthah earlier, back in chapter 11, where, you know, he was going to have a dynasty through his daughter, perhaps that would be the hope. And then of course she actually ends up becoming one of the virgins who serves permanently, a permanent virgin serving at the tabernacle. She's devoted to God because of his vow. So kingly aspirations, monarchical aspirations, the desire for a dynasty, that's the big thing. And some of the judges fall into that trap of wanting that. We're going to see that here. So first, Ibsen, he clearly fell into this sin of pursuing a dynasty. He's from Bethlehem, which is an interesting little detail given how much Bethlehem figures into the biblical narrative. But look at what it says in verse 9. He had 30 sons and 30 daughters. And so he had 60 children altogether. So what does that tell you? Obviously, he is a polygamist. No one woman is going to give birth to 30 sons and 30 daughters. So he's a polygamist. So he multiplies wives. That's one of the sins that kings fall into. A man should be so busy leaving his own family and cleaving to his wife that he doesn't have time for another woman. He doesn't have time to go get another wife. And Ibsen doesn't do that. It also, now this is a very interesting detail. I want you to think about this too. Verse 30, he brought in 30 daughters from elsewhere for his sons. Okay, and it also says he gave away his daughters in marriage. That doesn't really tell us a whole lot. But then he brought in 30 daughters, brought them in from where? From outside of his own people, outside of Israel. So think about this. Who are these marriages with and why would he do this? These marriages, and it, like if you know anything about medieval history, you often see this happen where there is a marriage that is arranged. You know, sometimes marriages would be arranged for economic reasons, but a lot of times marriages were arranged for political reasons to form an alliance. That if we can bring these two families together through members of the next generation getting married, that can create peace between these groups that might otherwise be at war. So it becomes a matter of a political alliance. And so if he gets if he brings in 30 daughters from elsewhere for his sons, that tells you he's entering into alliances with foreign powers, with pagan nations, and this was something that God had forbidden, these entangling alliances. So the issue here is not intermarriage. It's not an inter-ethnic marriage. The Bible does not have anything, there's no law in the Bible against what we might call interracial or inter-ethnic marriage per se. Whether or not that's wise in any given case, that's a question you can ask, but it's never unlawful. The only thing that would be unlawful would be marrying outside the faith. But that seems to be what's happening here, that the daughters are brought in from elsewhere for his sons because he's starting to act like a king and he's entering into alliances with these foreign powers as a way of keeping the peace. And then look at what happens in verse 10, what we're told. Ibsen died and was buried at Bethlehem, so in his hometown. So died and buried. And we're going to see this again and again, this refrain. I talked about how, you know, once you get through the Gideon part of the book, every single judge, it calls attention to his death. And it's as if to say, look, these judges, they only judged for so long. They might have rescued Israel from enemies. They might have done all kinds of great things. But in the end, they could not deliver the nation from death. They themselves died and were buried. And there's a tomb you can go look at, you know, in this case in Bethlehem, and see that, that the judge succumbed to death. There's this emphasis on death. The shadow of death hangs over all of these judges, you know, from the midpoint of the book on. And that tells us something about their failure, their weakness, their impetus, this emphasis on death and death getting the last word in their stories. What we're going to see, of course, what this going to point us to, and I'll come back to this in a minute, is the need for a judge who does not die, or does, if he does die, he doesn't stay dead, ultimately, is what they're going to need. So then verses 11 and 12, we come to Elon, okay, not Elon Musk, but just this minor judge, Elon. He is a Zebulunite. He judged Israel for 10 years. You know, it says with Ibsen, he judged Israel for 7 years. You know, we could do something with the numerology here. I'm not sure exactly what. I'm sure the numbers do have some kind of significance, but you got 7 years with Ibsen. That's the number of Sabbath rest and perfection. Here with Elon, you've got 10 years. Now we're not really told anything about him. So there's no indication that he pursued a dynasty. He must have done some noteworthy things or he wouldn't be included. But we're not given a record of any of his accomplishments other than the fact that he judged Israel. We know from the whole rest of the book that judges did not just handle court cases and render verdicts for, private persons in the nation, but they actually acted on behalf of the nation to bring judgment against Israel's enemies. And so through the judges, God passed judgment in favor of his people, and then that favorable judgment was enacted by the warfare of the judge, throwing off an oppressor and bringing freedom and deliverance and rescue and prosperity to the people. So Elon must have done something of this sort in his 10 years as a judge, but we're not told anything here about any dynastic aspirations, so there's no indication that he fell into that sin, that trap that the other judges did. But we do have in verse 12 a record of his death. He died and was buried. He was buried at Ajalon in the country of Zebulun. And again, you've got death getting the last word. And then in verses 13 to 15, we've got Abdon, okay, the son of Hillel, the Pirathonite who judged Israel. And again, so look at what we're told about him. Verse 14, he had 40 sons and then 30 grandsons, and they rode around on 70 young donkeys, and he judged Israel for 8 years. Okay, so again, it's a mixed bag. He was a judge, so no doubt he did many good things, but we're told the number of sons and daughters. Why are we given that? Why are we told records of battles and that kind of thing? Because that's not really important here. What's important is obviously he was trying to create a dynasty. His judgeship takes on all the trappings of a pagan kingdom, a pagan monarchy. You got the 40 and the 30, so it spans two generations, but it comes to 70. And that reminds us of Gideon. 70 was associated with Gideon's attempt to create a dynasty back in chapter 8. So you've got that connection here. And then they wrote about on donkeys. So it's not horses. So we haven't gotten to that phase of kingship. This is kind of like a low budget monarchy. Okay. This is the king. He doesn't have the big fancy limousine. He's got to ride around in a Toyota Camry. Okay. He didn't get the big fancy limousine for all his sons and grandsons. They just got to ride around in Camrys. The Toyota Camry, because they don't have that level of wealth. They don't have that level of status and prestige and all of that. They're elevating themselves towards a kind of kingly glory, but they obviously can't attain it because they just don't have that level of prosperity. So you've got 70 donkeys carrying around his sons and his grandsons. But again, look at this, in verse 15, it says Abdon died and was buried. And again, we have this attention call to the fact that the judge is dead and buried. again, all of these judges saved Israel. They all did great things, but whatever salvation they brought to the nation was a very imperfect and partial salvation. And what this does, remember, all of the judges, they're anointed with the Spirit, so they are messiahs, or we could call them Christs. They are types and pictures and foreshadowings of the Christ who is to come. The fact that all of these judges, that the salvation they brought, the judgment they rendered was incomplete, it was not a full deliverance, means that Israel is still awaiting a final judge who can bring a final deliverance, a full deliverance, a permanent deliverance. They need a judge who will not only die, but who will rise again. And in doing so, will bring a complete salvation and unity to God's people. What they need is a judge without a tombstone. It's like the whole record here says, look, you can go visit the tombstone of this judge if you want. And you can see where however much victory he got during his life, he got defeated by death. But with Jesus, there's no tombstone that you can go visit. There's no, you can't go to the place where Jesus is buried because Jesus rose from the dead. He's the ultimate judge. Death did not defeat him. He defeated death. As the ultimate judge, he passed judgment against all of our enemies. And in passing judgment against our enemies, that verdict has a follow through. And he delivered us from those enemies by rendering judgment in our favor. He also overthrew sin and death and Satan and has given us the victory. And that is our hope, that Jesus is our greater and final judge. And he accomplished what all of these other judges throughout the whole book, I mean, not just here, these minor judges, but all of these judges, what they accomplished in a very imperfect and shadowy way, he does in the perfect and full way. They were pictures of what was to come, but Jesus has accomplished it, and that's what we've got to see here. He's the ultimate judge, the true Messiah, the true Christ who has brought in salvation for God's people. So that is Judges 12. Thank you very much. Let's pray.